Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, March 12th, 2026. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Cedar, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live, steps, from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Murtaza Hussein of Dropsite News will be with us to talk about the latest on Trump and Israel's criminal war in Iran. Will Iran relent in the Strait? And more. Also on the program, Iran's new supreme leader issues his first statement saying the attacks on Gulf countries and Strait of Hormuz closures will continue as oil prices spike and people start to feel it at the pump in the U.S. U.S. intelligence has determined that the Iranian regime is not at risk of collapse anytime soon. Whoopsie! Multiple ships have been attacked in or near the Strait. Every Senate Democrat except for John Fetterschreck calls for the probe of the... the strike on the girls' school in Iran, which was confirmed to be on the U.S. target list. The Pentagon tells lawmakers that the Iran war has cost over $11 billion in less than 1 week. The Israeli military drops charges against five soldiers caught raping a Palestinian prisoner on camera.
They did arrest the woman who leaked the video, though.
I'm glad they're on top of that. Israel has killed at least 630 people, 91 of them children, in Lebanon in just the past week. If this were Europe, do you think that there would be any hesitation about causing Israel bombing seven countries a world war? One third of Americans, 82 million people, say they have had to cut spending to pay for healthcare costs last year, skipping meals and other examples. 85-year-old Jim Clyburn is running for re-election. Yes! Yes!
Disgusting.
What everyone wants. More gerontocracy. John Thune signals that the Senate will debate the Mass Voter Disenfranchisement Save Act next week as Cornyn reverses his position on the filibuster to pass it amidst a primary fight. And lastly, Kash Patel says UFC fighters will train FBI agents this week. Don't you feel safer already? All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome to the show, everybody. It's an M Majority Report Thursday. Hello, Matt. Hello, Brian. Hello, audience. I'm glad to be back. The news, not so much. Not so much. I'm excited to talk to Murtaza Hussein about some of Dropsite's excellent reporting on the Middle East, on this conflict, etc. But let's start here, because Trump is now basically saying that you just got to suck up higher gas prices. That's what his spin is this morning. But the national average for a gallon of gas has jumped around 35 cents in a week. And experts on energy are essentially saying that this is like the largest supply disruption in the history of the global oil market. Just to underscore the significance of this, the Iranians have shown no signs that they want to let up here, because what their objective is going to be is to cause enough campaign to the West that they're not going to indiscriminately bomb civilians and their country again. I mean, the new Supreme Leader's father and mother were just, or I'm not sure if it was actually his mother, but father and the wife of the Ayatollah were just killed in these strikes. Dozens more of senior leadership, and at least 1,300 people in Iran have been killed, let alone the environmental catastrophe that the Israelis and the United States set off by bombing the oil despots, definitely not right. Sometimes those similar words get mixed up in my brain. But this was Trump yesterday at a rally in Kentucky. Now we're moving from calling the war in Iran a limited operation or an operation to something different. Oh, it's like a little jaunt, potentially. Here he is with his new spin on this criminal war in the Middle East.
At the end of the year, we did an excursion. You know what an excursion is? We had to take a little trip to get rid of some evil, very evil people. It should have been done. For 47 years, they've been killing our people. 47 years.
Cattle.
47 years. And I can only say this. They were all prepared. They're very strong. You know, they're going to try and take over the whole Middle East. They were going to knock out Israel. They don't know what the hell hit them, right? They don't know what hit them. They got hit by the American military. They don't know. They say, what the hell is happening? They didn't expect anything like this. To bring down energy costs for American workers and families and businesses like this one, we ended the Green News scam. You know the scam?
Bringing down energy costs, huh? Mm-hmm. First of all, a little excursion to get rid of some really evil people.
The people that wanted to take over the Middle East, and it's not Israel.
Yeah. As the opposition leader to Netanyahu is endorsing the greater Israel theory, and that guy's supposed to be the liberal in the Israeli body politic representation. Yeah, no, we're pretty sure we know which entity in the Middle East is trying to take over the whole thing. So he's talking about how the Green New Scam, which was never passed, but Biden did have some green-related infrastructure projects as a part of his legislative agenda that the Trump administration just halted, even sometimes in the middle of construction, that would have brought down energy costs for people because our grid is so overloaded right now due to the giveaways to AI and the data centers that are trying to outpace local opposition and build and build and build and use all of their energy and raise people's electricity prices so they can beat the clock before they're regulated. Those guys, the AI guys, are all in bed with Donald Trump, and they're raising energy prices as Trump is killing projects that would have helped energy prices and starting a criminal war in the Middle East that is resulting already in just a week in massive increases for prices at the pump. As I mentioned, it's been a 35-cent increase in a week. And the markets are starting to understand that and not listening to Trump trying to talk people off the ledge right as the markets close. So this is where Trump is moving his messaging at this point. He's got to do the weave and pivot. The United States is the largest oil producer in the world, he said this morning, by far. So when oil prices go up, we make a lot of money. Who's we here? But of far greater interest and importance to me as president is stopping an evil empire, Iran, from having nuclear weapons and destroying the Middle East, and indeed the world.
Mm-hmm, sure.
I won't ever let that happen. Thank you for your attention to this matter, blah, blah.
I'm sure the whole freedom across the other side of the world thing he cares about as much as the all of my buddies are going to get rich off of the price of liquid natural gas going up, and we're actually going to be insulated from the price y'all schmucks feel at the pump.
And it's interesting you say that, because this was an analysis here done by Science Direct, where they looked at the fossil fuel profits. And this is a chart here that shows that 50% of all profit, I'm going to read here from the study, claims by U.S. beneficiaries are held by the top 1% of wealth owners and 84% by the top 10%. And you can see here that, in contrast, the bottom half of the population receive hardly any profits at all, only 1%. The top 0.1%, 131,000 households, receive 26 times as much as half of all Americans on profits for oil.
So, yeah, rich assholes who are going to stand to benefit from being investors in this stuff, they'll happily pay, fill up their Maseratis with, you know, $5 a gallon gas. It's you, everyone else that works for a living, that's going to have to feel that. And that's just, you know, look, freedom. It's worth it. It's a small price to pay.
So the spin now is that you may be paying more at the pump, but it's really good for making me and my friends rich. It's amazing to have him just say it out loud.
The truth, these people are insulated from all of this stuff. They don't care. They don't care if there's a recession. They don't care about any of that. Because if there's a recession, they just get to buy stuff up for
free. On the cheap. That is what. That is why wealth concentration at this level is so dangerous, is because they're the ones who can benefit from the dip. We saw that income inequality got worse after the Great Recession because Obama and the Democrats, along with the Republicans, ended up bailing out the banks as opposed to homeowners directly. And it's not like that money trickled down. We saw that it allowed them to reset and continue to rip off people and buy politicians and get richer and richer.
I mean, they are marching on us. Zuckman, who worked with Thomas Piketty on the inequality and capital in the 21st century, points out, like, it's been every year since then, they've reached record highs in the amount of wealth concentrated at the top. We have put the Gilded Age in the rearview mirror. It looks quaint compared to what we see now.
Yep. The age of oligarchs. And speaking of those oligarchs, here's another piece that I wanted to kind of hit on as we're in the midst of this horrific war. Just bringing up the name Krupp, I think that's how you pronounce it. For this reason, Nazi Germany's arms manufacturer, some of the
big steelworks, Krupp, K-R-U-P-P.
Just some of the companies, corporations that worked closely with the Nazis during Hitler's rule. It's important to point out that there will be many corporations and companies that are known, that will be complicit when we look back in this moment in history. But I'm not sure if there's one company and corporation that will be more complicit in Trump's crimes, both domestically and internationally, than Palantir. Palantir was a part of helping the IDF create their AI Lavender bombing technology kill lists in Gaza, where they had different programs, including one that was called Daddy's Home, where they would bomb residences with anyone that they suspected was a Hamas militant. And it didn't essentially matter if their entire family was there.
Yeah, anybody they suspect of being a Hamas militant means any male from the age of 12 up.
And we know from the Epstein emails that Peter Thiel was connected with Jeffrey Epstein, and then Epstein connected him to Ehud Barak. And that was conveniently when Israel, shortly after that, ended up opening its Tel Aviv office and was a part of the Palestine laboratory experiment, where they essentially test out surveillance and weapons technology on the Palestinians in Gaza. And this is how Palantir got to where it is and why it's one of the biggest corporations in the country right now. And also on the backs of the U.S. taxpayer. There is no company that I think has gotten more contracts under the Trump administration than Palantir. In July, the Army issued a contract with Palantir worth up to $10 billion over a decade. And that includes a nearly $800 million intelligence targeting software, this thing called Maven. And Maven uses Anthropic's AI tool Claude, and Anthropic has been getting a lot of good press for trying to say that they don't want the Trump administration to use some of their technology. In fact, the Pentagon ended up retaliating against them because they had some qualms about the use of their technology in wartime. Now, cynically, my view is that Anthropic is looking beyond the Trump administration to a new administration that might want to have the good AI on their side. OpenAI is angling in the same way as the Palantir gets richer and richer. But Alex Karp, said on CNBC that they're still using this technology. It's integrated into Maven. So for all of Anthropic's kind of public stance on this, their technology is still being used right now in wartime by Palantir. Palantir also, of course, we know has gotten billions and no-bid contracts for ICE. And the number of federal contracts that they had doubled in 2025. So that's...
This is a company reliant on taxpayer money. They don't do anything else besides that.
And here is Palantir CEO Alex Karp talking about why he supports Trump's war in Iran. I wonder why, given all the context that I gave you. He's was on CNBC this morning, and this is him lobbying for even more contracts from the federal government. You should view this appearance in that light.
The total power of our fleet and all of our resources and bring it to bear against adversaries and enemies has shifted the way in which war is fought. And I have read that Palantir's Project Maven is the core backbone of that. And then I've also read that all the allies, Arab and non-Arab in the Middle East, may or may not be users of our platform as well, and that's expanding rapidly. I think the most important thing, leaving aside the heroism of our troops, which is the most important thing, is our adversaries and enemies are witnessing an ability to fight that they don't have. And they are going to find it very hard to acquire for a couple reasons. We have, for better or worse, as many know, I've been essentially an anti-neocon. Mm-hmm. I don't really believe in the wars we fought in the past, but because I don't believe in regime change, and that's one of the reasons I'm supportive of this policy that we currently have. But what you want is to have a capacity that no one else can replicate, and America is the center of the AI revolution.
Nope.
The large language models on the battlefield are only useful if powered inside an ontology, and that's our ontology. And, yeah, I guess I've read we're at the core of everything, and maybe that's exaggerated.
Maybe.
Yeah, but for investor pitch.
Yeah, on CNBC. I found that amazing. I've not been supportive of regime change wars in the past. Did he say that on Joe Rogan or something like that? They know that they have some issue with their past statements on this. But with this war, which the Trump administration said was for the purpose of regime change until they said it was actually for to destroy their nuclear program, but they'd already destroyed the nuclear program last year. They now know that they can't do regime change. U.S. intelligence assessments have shown that the infrastructure of the Iranian government has stayed in place in spite of the sadistic bombing campaigns that our government has engaged in. And anybody who has any familiarity with the Iranian state would have been able to tell the administration that. But they still use the concept of regime change to push this war forward. So Karp is just like lying based on the past 48 hours of changing PR from the Trump administration, because it's another public bid for more free money from our government.
We have the AI revolution has given us capabilities that the Iranians could never imagine, like the capability to double tap a school and then pretend like, whoopsie daisy, that was a mistake somehow with our great capabilities.
So that's the big, I think, also reason that he's probably on television, is if it gets out that Palantir's supposedly incredibly precise technology of AI bombings was involved in selecting this target, this school for little girls that may have been a military installation 10 years ago, We had Robert Pape on the show to talk about how it is a complete fallacy that in the smart bomb era that institute a regime change, which Karp is now saying he's not in favor of.
You can't aerially bomb your way to victory.
Right. You can't aerially bomb your way to victory. But also we know that, they didn't have the intelligence necessary to know what they were striking, even if they can be precise in the way that the Israelis can, where they send a drone down and assassinate a doctor in a hospital, know exactly where he is, and that's probably Palantir's technology too. Well, it looks like U.S. maps might have been outdated, and Palantir's technology can't solve that, buddy. So, like, they're constantly trying to oversell the efficacy of their technology, and they'll do that also by saying, like, God, it could be this really terrifying tool, but we could also use it for good.
Oh, sure, yeah. They don't have a business model besides selling it to the government to surveil you and to kill kids. There's no business model for these AI companies to exit all the amount that people have invested in. It's a big house of cards, and the only way it's being sustained is based on government money.
And this is the other angle that he took trying to appeal to Republicans in the Trump administration on its economic benefits. This was immensely cynical as well, because he's going to try to drive a wedge here and say that AI is going to be liberatory, maybe not for all people in America. We're going to have to start to concede that they're going to take jobs away from people. But worry not, Trump administration. It will benefit, wink and a nod, your voters, maybe.
Industry has to support the warfighter. The one thing, though, that I think even now is underestimated by all actors in industry, and including in Silicon Valley, is how disruptive these technologies are. If you are going to disrupt the economic and therefore political power significantly of one party space, highly educated, often female voters who vote mostly Democrat, and military and working class people who do not feel supported, and you feel like you believe that's going to work out politically, you're in an insane asylum. Like, that you cannot have it. This technology disrupts humanity's trained, largely Democratic voters, and makes their economic power less, and increases the power, economic power of vocationally trained, working class, often male voters. And so, these disruptions are going to disrupt every aspect of our society. And to make this work, we have to come to an agreement of what it is we're going to do with the technology. How are we going to explain to people who are likely going to have less good and less interesting jobs from their perspective? And how is it that we are going? And by the way, on the military thing, these technologies are dangerous societally. The only justification you could possibly have would be that if we don't do it, our adversaries will do it, and we will be subject to their rule of law. So if you decouple this from the support
their
of the
rule
military,
of law. All right, that's really good. That means that we need the Americans to get behind our AI technology, because we have copyright protections here in the United States and intellectual property. And in other countries, that's not necessarily the same law. So as we talk about this as an AI arms race, you need to give us boatloads of money, because we need to keep up with the Chinese here, but keep up with them
they
in a
will
way
keep up with
that
us.
Protects our our wealth and
Monopoly.
Our intellectual property.
And
yeah.
it's foolish. It's throwing good money after bad. China last year created an AI that basically does everything you need with using less energy. They will continue to do that. There's nothing you can do to stop them from continuing to do that. So betting that we're going to be able to create an AI god that keeps America the innovation capital of the world, we're losing that. It's because of people like this. Because we keep giving them whatever they want instead of solving real problems, like how do I get from Chicago to New York? It's to give these freaks money so they can put everything you've ever done and everything you ever scrolled and every like checkout page you've ever shopped online into a fucking database so they can protect your information for marketers. And if you say anything bad about their allies, they can create a dossier on you so the government can track you down. Like, we're not solving real problems because of crackheads like this guy.
Yeah, yeah, that's exactly right. And when he mentions there too let's put up three just so to bolster your point about how much money has been given. Like, this is Palantir. This is a chart from a month ago. Palantir went public on the New York Stock Exchange in September 30th, 2020, with a price of $7.25 per share. It closed on its first day trading at $9.50. And now you can see, at least in February, it was at $147 a share. And that is in large part due to your money, taxpayer money, giveaways by the taxpayer for the enrichment of guys like Alex Karp.
And the rich people that are giving money to Palantir, they're throwing money at politicians to make sure that the government, their politicians make sure the government gives money to Palantir. It's a self-feeding loop.
And the last thing on this is that when he's appealing there to the MAGA base and says that it's a good thing women are going to be impacted more by AI replacing their jobs.
No more Gen Z boss in a mini.
Yeah. And that means they get to be back in the home. That's almost the implication of what he's saying. Now, it is true that white collar workers, which is what the implication of what he's saying, when you look at them as a whole, are a little bit more disproportionately women on like the entry level, but they're more disproportionate on the lower level white collar scale. I was reading, there's something in Pew that was analyzing this from a few months ago. They're overrepresented in lower paying jobs in like the more professional setting that he's saying is only going to be impacted there. So yeah, their jobs are likely to be replaced by AI. But what he's talking about with men in manufacturing, working class males, no, it might be even worse in those situations. We're already seeing how AI manufacturing and AI robotics are replacing those jobs at a rapid rate. Manufacturing jobs are on the decline under Donald Trump rapidly after we bounce back under Biden due to infrastructure investment. So what Karp is saying there is a lie. Saying it on a national news platform, a financial news platform, in order to appeal to a specific Republican constituency and stave off a populist anger about AI, which is pretty bipartisan. When you look at some of the polling on this, especially in areas where their data centers are really harming electricity bills and the environments in certain communities, Karp has got to be aware of some of that backlash. Plus, this really unpopular war where your AI technology is telling the Americans, time to bomb this school, might be a problem.
Hakeem Jeffries, you going to take their money still?
Apparently. In a moment, we're going to be talking to Murtaza Hussein. But first, a word from our sponsors. Raise your hand if you've been putting off a dental cleaning, an annual checkup, or honestly, any kind of doctor's appointment. Well, podcast audience, my hand is up too. When something feels off, I'm tempted to self-diagnose, just, you know, look things up on the internet, spiral, downplay it, and say I'm probably fine. Well, if that sounds familiar, this year, let's do things differently. Let's find doctors we love and book appointments with ZocDoc. ZocDoc is a free app and website which helps you find and book high-quality in-network doctors so you can find someone you love. We're talking about booking in-network appointments with more than 150,000 providers across all 50 states. Whether you're looking for dermatology, dentistry, primary care, eye care, or one or the other, 200-plus specialties offered on ZocDoc, you can easily search by specialty or symptom to build the care team that is right for you. You can do in-person visits, video visits, whatever you prefer. When you're ready, you can see their real-time availability and click to book instantly. No phone tag, no waiting around. Appointments made through ZocDoc happen fast, typically within just 24 to 72 hours of booking. You can even score same-day appointments. I literally just used ZocDoc yesterday to finally book my dental cleaning. I'm doing it, my annual dental cleaning. I've been putting it off. Well, you're supposed to do it twice a year. So I'm maybe like a little 8 months past my last one. Finally booked it for next week, and ZocDoc made it as easy as possible. It's where I also found my dentist. I'd like to thank ZocDoc for sponsoring today's episode. Stop putting off those doctor's appointments and go to ZocDoc.com/majority to find and instantly book a doctor you love today. That's ZocDoc.com/majority, ZocDoc.com/majority. Thanks to ZocDoc for sponsoring this message. We'll put a link down below in the video and episode descriptions and at majority.fm. And lastly, are you numb to it yet? This insane ride of life that we've been living lately. You've got AI coming for your jobs, geopolitical turmoil, to put it mildly. The market's bouncing around everywhere. It's no wonder most of us are hunkering down, saving, and looking for ways to protect our futures. You've heard of life insurance, but did you know that it's cheaper than you think? For around the same price per month as one of your streaming services, you can get the right life insurance policy. The younger you are, the cheaper it is, like double the price if you wait to buy a decade from now. And that is why I am looking for a life insurance policy today with SelectQuote. If you're new to life insurance, you are not alone. For over 40 years, SelectQuote has helped more than 2 million Americans understand their options and get the coverage they need. As a broker, their mission is simple, to find you the right insurance policy at the best price. Sam has spoken about this, how easy it is. SelectQuote has made it incredibly easy to find a great life insurance policy. And, you know, you gotta, when you're younger, even, you may not want to think about it, right? Like, it's a little bit of stuff that you think it's never going to happen to you, especially when you're younger. But SelectQuote is on a mission to make sure that you have the security, even if you don't want to be thinking about it and it's in the back of your mind. SelectQuote takes the guesswork out of finding the right life insurance policy. You don't have to sort through dozens of confusing options on your own. Instead, one of their licensed agents will find the right policy at the right price for you, comparing plans from trusted, top-rated insurance companies to find a policy that fits your health, lifestyle, and your budget, and they work for you for free. You'll be covered faster than you think. SelectQuote works with providers who offer same-day coverage and up to $2 million worth with no medical exam required. And you're not out of luck if you have pre-existing health conditions, because SelectQuote partners with companies that offer policies for people with conditions like high blood pressure, diabetes, heart disease, etc. SelectQuote makes life insurance simple. Even if this is your first time thinking about it, head to selectquote.com/majority and a licensed insurance agent will call you right away with the right policy for your life and your budget. Life insurance is never cheaper than it is today. Get the right life insurance for you for less and save more than 50% at selectquote.com/majority. Save more than 50% on term life insurance at selectquote.com/majority today to get started. That's selectquote.com/majority. They shop, you save. Link below in the video and episode descriptions and at majority.fm. Quick break. When we come back, we'll be joined by Murtaza. We'll be right back. We are back, and we are joined by, once again by Murtaza Hussein, reporter covering national security and foreign affairs at Dropside News. Murtaza, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Emma.
Of course. Good to see you. Good to talk to you. Let's start here. What is the latest on the closure of the Strait of Hormuz? Because the new line from the Trump administration is short-term pain for long-term gain. What is your assessment of that spin? What is the long-term gain here?
Well, it's really a risible statement. And I think Trump has gotten himself into a situation which is far more serious than he may have calculated at the beginning. For those who don't know, the Strait of Hormuz is a passageway, a relatively narrow maritime passageway through which about 20% of the world's energy transits. And you can imagine the knock-on effects of a disruption of that strait for even a few hours or a day or so. In the 80 years it's been used for this purpose, it's never really been shut down at all. Now we're over a week now of disruption and total shutdown of the strait to various degrees. And it looks like the Iranians are digging in to shut it down for a long period of time. So crude oil today has already exceeded $100 Brent crude per barrel. It was from about $68 at the start of the war. So that's an unbelievable sort of parabolic increase in a short amount of time. And the market is still pricing in a relatively short war, although there's no really indication of an off-ramp here. So, you know, this is kind of a devastating situation for, first of all, the global economy, obviously the American economy, American domestic politics being impacted, but also the whole structure of the American empire is very much based on the idea that the U.S. is the protector of this area, of the Persian Gulf, of the Gulf Arab countries around the Strait of Hormuz in the Gulf, and then also of the Strait itself and the maritime traffic. And it turns out that the Iranians can control the Strait. The U.S. does not have the ability to defend the countries around the Gulf. It does not have the ability to defend the Strait from someone taking it over, the Iranians in this case. And, you know, if they were to, let's say, launch a major operation to open it, that would take, you know, a very long time to get together. Even escorting ships through would take a very long time. It would be very dangerous as well, too. You could make weeks or months even to organize the logistics for that. And then, very likely, you'd have to invade Iran. You'd have to invade Iran in the coastal areas bordering the Gulf to sort of regain control of that. And that would be an incredibly difficult task. You'd suffer. You'd need like Iraq-style beyond level of invasion force, again, which would take a very long time. And during all that time, the strait is still closed and the global economy is still being impacted. So you are really, you've almost generated a situation where you're almost guaranteed a global recession or global depression even as a result of this huge shock to global energy markets by this decision to launch the war and then for the Iranians to close the strait. So I really see only a few really unenviable options for Trump now. The first is he could do that. He could escalate and start a much larger war with Iran, including a ground invasion and what have you, to try to open the strait by force. Again, it would have all the negative consequences I talked about. And on top of you being very unpopular in America, the war is already unpopular, being worse if they have the ground invasion and casualties and all these things. It would be devastating. Secondly, he could just sort of back off. He could declare the war over and say he's done with it, regardless of what's going on the ground. He's hinted that he is on the verge of doing that anyways. He's been saying several times he wants to wrap it up already. It's only been about 2 weeks now. But then what do you do then? He's effectively surrendered the Strait and the Persian Gulf to Iran, because Iran would be have demonstrated they're the power, were able to have control over it. So what does that mean? All the Gulf Arab countries will have to reorient themselves towards accommodating Iran. Iran's status will be tremendously boosted as a result of that. So that's not really a great option for Trump either. So I don't really know what his end game here is. Maybe he can negotiate something with the Iranians and give them something that allows them to back off or makes them feel comfortable backing off. But I'm really skeptical of that too, because the Iranians don't trust any U.S. negotiating position, because the last two negotiations, the U.S. attacked them in the middle of the negotiation. And that sort of duplicitous behavior in diplomacy was not even done in World War II. Because you know that, you know, whatever morals, ethics aside, you may need to talk to someone later on. You may need them to trust your assurances in negotiation. The U.S. doesn't really have that option anymore. So they're trying to bomb Iran in submission, cause all the civilian casualties, just harm them and so forth, see if they'll break. That seems to not be working. It seems to be having the opposite effect. They nominated even more hardline supreme leader, who today gave his first address saying that, first and foremost, the war is not going to end. We're not opening the strait. So now what? So I don't see a really a good off-ramp for this. Vietnamese.
And the Trump administration and the U.S. is claiming that it's destroying these Iranian mine layers. It does not appear that they are successful, but they are trying to at least kind of give the impression that they're having some impact on the mines that the Iranians have laid in the strait. What's your assessment on that?
Well, these mine layers, they're just like speedboats, and the Iranians apparently have thousands of them. And I think the U.S. CENTCOM said it's short 16, some of which may have been inactive. That doesn't really move the needle too much on the subject. The Iranians can just place a few mines in the strait and it's closed. If they place thousands or tens of thousands of mines, you can imagine how long it would take to clean that up, even if the war did go in America's favor later on. So it's not really such a pertinent issue. But secondly, it's two things. First of all, the Iranians have developed ballistic missiles, which can be used to lay mines as well, too. So there are certain types of missiles they've developed, which you fire them in the strait, and they discharge mines anyway. So you don't even need the boats. They've thought through many different ways of doing this. And secondly, you know, the Iranians don't need to mine the straits to close it. All they have to do is declare the strait is closed, and then it's closed. Because ships won't take the insurance cost of going through an air region that they view as dangerous. The ship's crews won't want to do it even just for their own safety as well, too. And most of the ships, or all the ships that have been hit so far, have not been hit by mines, they've been hit by drones. And the drones are launched from within Iran. So the mines are really a secondary issue. They've built all these redundancies into their strategy for closing the strait. And I think the fundamental problem this whole conflict is that from Trump's perspective, this was an issue on his checklist he was trying to get off before he moved on to Cuba or ICE or a million other things. From the Iranians' perspective, this is a conflict they've been preparing for several generations now, the day that the U.S. came to try to invade them, and they view it as an existential issue. And the Trump administration has said it's an existential issue for the Iranians, so they're sort of viewing it appropriately. So they haven't thought of this a million different ways, what they would do in the situation, and the Trump administration has seemingly done no preparation for this. I'll give you one more quick example. The reason that the Iranians are even able to shut down the strait is because these bases that the U.S. have built around the Gulf, which is supposed to protect the strait and protect the countries in the Gulf, they were evacuated before the war because the U.S. didn't want to take casualties. And now those bases are being hit very heavily, radars are being knocked out, all these things. There have been some casualties in Kuwait as well, too, and maybe in Saudi Arabia from the attacks on these bases. But now you don't even have the bases necessary to project the force to reopen the strait in the first place. So how do you even get out of this without going a million times more deeply into it? And if you even if you do invade Iran, it's not even clear that you'd win that war. It's a very mountainous country. Oh. It's 90,000 people.
Yeah.
They've been preparing again for the invasion as well, too. So, yeah, I mean, I think that we're headed for a huge economic catastrophe here, barring some sort of, unlikely at the moment, diplomatic off-ramp.
Claim that let me pick up on something else that you said there, because I think that's really important, where you're talking about the interceptors and the United States running low on them. We saw them getting hit pretty hard. We saw that Korean media ended up publishing a few days ago an image of the United States dismantling one of their defense systems from South Korea to send it to the Middle East. Obviously, North Korea is one of the, few nations isolated from the West that has refused to denuclearize. And so it appears that the U.S. is so desperate for this kind of technology that Trump doesn't really care if this ally is, put in a difficult position. And also, I think they took some heat domestically for allowing the construction of this previously. But perhaps you can shed some light on this.
So these missile interceptors, they're a very important part of America's defense strategy, not just in the Middle East, but globally. Because, it's actually what's happening right now is increasing the risk of a war in Asia. Because the reason there's not a war in Asia is because the countries in Asia that the U.S. has conflicts and hostility with believe the cost is too high, or they believe their missiles won't get through, or things like that. So if you move the missile batteries out of Asia, it makes the idea of, let's say, North Korea attacking South Korea or China attacking Taiwan more attractive, because they feel that, it's becoming easier now. The missile batteries are gone, and we're building up our own missiles ourselves. you know, the balance of forces is getting more on our side. So this is actually increasing the risk of a major war in Asia at the same time, either now or in a year or two, because, you know, one thing's very important, these missile batteries are not easy to replenish. The U.S. makes a couple dozen a year, and they fired no one knows how many in this war, but in the last 2025 war, Israel-Iran war, they fired about 25% of all their missiles. So, you know, years conservatively of production are being expended on this, as giving, let's say, the Chinese a very perfect window of opportunity to, let's say, attack Taiwan or attack U.S. interests in the region and become the hegemon of that part of the world. So it's really cannibalizing all aspects of America's, the imperial American system, the physical footprint of it, to fight this war, which is a war of choice and for which no one has actually defined any objective at all in Iran, and no one's defined endgame. It's really crazy. So, you know, you mentioned that the intercepts are running out too. These figures are classified, but you can kind of see the impact a little bit, because in Dubai, which is a beneficiary of a lot of American interceptors, the interceptions are not happening anymore. The strikes are happening on Dubai more and more heavily. And this is going to cause a death spiral for Dubai, because the whole attraction of Dubai and the other Gulf Arab states is that they're a completely safe haven for capital and individuals from around the world to come and invest and things like that. That's clearly no longer the case. The U.S. is not able to defend them. It's not defending them. They're being hammered. And then the next shoe to drop might be Israel. Like, Israel is now engaged in another war with Hezbollah. They're being hit. The Iranians' focus is now shifting to the Gulf states to hit Israel more often. So if they run out of interceptors and start running low, then what happens exactly? So I see this as complete Pandora's box, which has been opened. And like I said, the implications are not just for the Middle East. They have implications for Europe and the war with Russia, but also for the war which may take place, which now is odds are being increased with China or with North Korea. And that war would be magnitudes more damaging than the war with Iran. As bad as the war with Iran has been, that would be truly, you know, a situation which would be deserving of the description of a world war if that were to happen. And, you know, people before the Trump administration, even people in the current administration, have warned about this and warned not to do it, and yet they're doing it as we speak.
Well, I guess this, for South Korea's purposes, they can maybe be a little bit less concerned about an attack from China, in my estimation, because why would China really do anything except sit back and watch the United States expend enormous amounts of military resources right now, destroy their global standing in the world, especially when China's reliance on oil that's coming through the strait is less significant than some of the other countries. Like, say, I know Pakistan is experiencing that crunch right now. South Korea is likely to be impacted, Japan as well. But China can kind of just wait this out and essentially say, like, hey, the U.S., you want to punch yourself in the face? Go for it.
Well, this is just an unbelievable, so like the knock-on effects are so crazy, because you mentioned Pakistan and many other Asian countries, there's like rationing happening in these countries. People are being told to work from home and not drive their cars. Entire countries, you're talking about hundreds of millions, maybe billions of people who are currently going through this in Asia at the moment. And one country not affected is China. For a number of reasons, they have strategic reserves situations like this. They're a large, well-resourced country. But also, Iran is still selling its own oil through the strait. Its own ships are passing. They're selling more, actually, at higher prices. Right. And who's buying them? China's buying them. Because China was willing to sort of ignore the sanctions and buy the Iranian oil. It almost makes you think that this is somehow coordinated, so strategically perfect for China in this situation, because it's heavily damaging all the rival or competing powers around them in Asia. They're okay. They're still getting oil even. And it's also draining America's resources and political attention and, many other the critical factors they would need to contain or compete with China in the future. This does remind me a lot of the position of the U.S. in the world wars, because before the world wars, the U.S. was not a global superpower. The European countries were global superpowers, and it seemed like it was almost like an invulnerable position of superiority. What happened in the two world wars is the European countries exhausted themselves fighting. And by the end of World War II, the U.S. had taken much more of a supplementary role later in the conflict. It wasn't one of the initiating parties that suffered most of the damage or loss. It was the only country standing and became the global superpower which exists today. what China is doing is very similar. They are not getting involved directly in the Ukraine war or the Iran war. They're feeding weapons. They're giving intel. They're giving other sources of support to help Iran or help Russia and keep the war going longer. But they're not going to waste their own resources getting involved in the war of choice like that. They're just sitting and capitalizing on the benefits. And I do think this is going to end up being a historical turning point, one way or another, given what they're doing, which, frankly, is quite wise.
I mean, so China has these reserves. They also are much further along on the renewable energy front, where they have that capacity, where the United States doesn't. And, of course, some of the other smaller Asian countries that are going to be impacted by this. When you're comparing it to World War II, I had been kind of thinking about this. I was listening to Jeffrey Sachs speak about how this is already a world war. And I don't see how you can classify it any other way. If this was in Europe and there was a country that was attacking seven other countries, bombing them, invading them in the way that Israel is, and as the proxy of the United States, I don't think we would have any hesitation in calling it a world war. But because of kind of, you know, Western privilege, there's a sneering at the sovereignty of nations in the Middle East and also Iran, of course, that prevents it from kind of being classified as such. But certainly also with all these Western countries involved in this multi-nation war, it would be fair to classify it as such. And obviously the U.S. and Israel are on the sides of aggression and cruelty.
Well, yeah, you know, it's also very important that a lot of these countries, like several countries being hit by Israel, several countries being hit by Iran now too, in the Gulf, in the Persian Gulf as well. Iran is a very, you know, different country from a lot of the other countries that the U.S. has fought in the last decade or two decades in the Middle East, in the sense that it has a sort of, it wasn't created by Sykes-Picot. It has its own natural borders, you could say. It was a civilization which was destroyed and then recreated itself several times in history as well, too. It's much more that the foundations of its statehood don't have a recent provenance. That's why I think that when Trump thought that he just killed one guy, the whole thing would collapse, he didn't really understand what the situation was. It was not a personalistic regime centered around a dictator who, you know, his bloodline or whatever, or his personality sort of defined the state. And without that, it would just be anybody. No, it's a deeply entrenched system. And maybe it's not popular with the majority of people. Maybe it's like a third of the people support it. But that's a lot in a country of 90 million people. That's enough to create a strong social base. And you can see that the government has not collapsed. So these characterizations of it seemingly did not match reality. These very optimistic characterizations of what would happen should the war have begun. So I do think that, you know, I don't know, it's really going to become now a contest of political will. And in some ways, it does seem to me that as bad as it is, the best option for Trump maybe should just be to walk away now and just declare victory. You can say he destroyed the Iranian Navy or killed such and such people and just say he won. And, you know, his supporters, many of them almost have this uncritical support of him. Maybe they'll buy enough that we just walk away. But, you know, I don't really know what he's going to do other than that, other than going more deeply in and getting into situations even more of a disaster.
I agree that domestically, politically, it would make the most sense for him to do that. But he has been, really talked into this by Netanyahu, by seemingly Lindsey Graham. The reporting was that Laura Loomer and Tom Cotton were some of the voices that he was listening to. And if you're listening to Tom Cotton, that is perhaps the most bloodthirsty person in the Senate. And yes, I'm including Lindsey Graham in that. Graham is just much more vocal and enjoying his appearances on cable television after a few drinks or something like that. But, you know, it is pretty horrifying that Trump seems to have listened so quickly to the neocons and acted with such urgency that, and look, this is part of his proclivity as well. I don't want to let him off the hook there, but the way that he launched this war seemed to have such little forethought that it's hard for me to view it as anything except him kind of ordering his cronies to act immediately.
Well, you know, Trump's, whole self-image is as an iconoclast. He's like the person who does what everyone else says you can't do, and then he gets away with it. And it seems like that was working for him. He was on like a gambling streak where he was hitting. Like, he killed Qasem Soleimani in 2020. Nothing really happened. He bombed the Iranian nuclear program. Nothing really happened. He just last month, seems so long ago, sorry, in January, He captured Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. Again, he got away with it. So I guess in his view, this was just another sort of thing he was going to do that someone said he couldn't do, and then he would win and he'd be seen as a maverick. But he miscalculated, because the Iranians, actually, it's a very important and sort of ironic aspect of this, is that the person, the one individual who was holding back the Iranians from retaliating more forcefully, even in the last Trump term, was Ali Khamenei. Ali Khamenei is a very elderly, was a very elderly man. He was very risk averse. He had a policy of not having a war with America, not developing a nuclear weapon, not having peace with America either, not giving up the nuclear program itself, but just not crossing any threshold, staying in a gray zone all the time. He's a very cautious individual. And many other people that the U.S. has killed in the last 2 years were very cautious. Hassan Nasrallah was also a very cautious individual. So now he has a younger generation of people, more hardcore in Iran, who never agree with this and who view it as an existential crisis, and they've been preparing
and,
for this.
Murtaza, sorry, just to interject, who also witnessed what happened to Gaddafi when he gave up his nuclear program and the United States still overthrew him, and he was executed in like the most gruesome possible way. Younger leadership, I would imagine, in Iran is saying, like, we don't want to end up like this, or I don't want to end up like my dad.
Absolutely. They know very well. And the U.S. credibility in negotiating these things is like nil now. Like, you can say that there were some U.S. administrations which are more conciliatory, but you have to look at the whole view, U.S. system in its totality. I don't think the U.S. is structurally capable of making a deal with Iran. They made one in 2015 under Obama, and it was torn up a few years later. That was pretty much it. There's no real consensus for that without that. And, you know, it's really kind of depressing a little bit, because I would even say that the Democrats, while they're not the ones who initiated this war, I think they also helped lead Trump into this. We had some reports about this at DropSite. It was not that they egged the war on explicitly, but they didn't really oppose it. And I think the reason is, and people said this, is that they view it as an opportunity to trap Trump, to destroy the Trump presidency, destroy the GOP. You know, it'll destroy Iran and kill off people in Iran anyways, but, well, we get our political win out of it. And a lot of people in the Democratic Party wanted to have a war with Iran, but they just didn't want to be paid this horrible cost that's now going to be paid by Trump and the whole global economy as a result of that. They want someone else to do it. And so Trump just happened to be the patsy for Netanyahu and for some of the Democrats and these people around him he mentioned, who was stupid enough to do it, to stupid enough to sacrifice his presidency and enter this quagmire that U.S. presidents have resisted doing for over 30 years.
And when we talk about the Democrats, I think it's also notable that when, you know, Iran has no incentive to negotiate with the United States or the Israelis any further, because the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal that you just referenced, it being torn up immediately by Trump when he got into office in the first term, meant that the Democratic Party actually retreated into a position that was way more hawkish than Obama's even policy on that. Like, to your point about where the Democrats are right now, Chuck Schumer, who was against the Iran deal, became the leader of the Democrats in the Senate. And the Israel lobby, for their money, got even more powerful, because in a post-Obama world, not to say that Obama was antagonistic to Israel, but at the very least, this was not something that the Zionist lobby wanted. They kind of quadrupled down their efforts on the Democratic Party and were able to buy them as opposition and undercut them. And that's part of probably why we're in this position.
Totally. I think it's a corruption and infiltration of the American political system. And, you know, it's not just me saying this, you saying this. You know, members of Congress are saying this. Chris Murphy was saying it. Many other people are pointing out. Bloomberg and, you know, mainstream news organizations are pointing out that the U.S. is sort of dog-walked into a war by the Israeli prime minister, by the prime minister of a foreign country, the manipulation of the people around him, people who are basically almost like acting as agents of Israel, who are embedded in the U.S. government, Jared Kushner, Steve Witkoff, behaving in that manner. They were instrumental to engineering the circumstance. And it's so glaring this time that it's almost hard. It's a conspiracy to deny it at this time. That's supposed to be a conspiracy to say it's happening. And I do remember the run-up to the Iraq War. And, you know, in retrospect, it was seen as such a scandal and unprofessionalism and failures and deceit that led to the war. That was like a masterclass in professionalism and honesty compared to this. This is a parodic reprise of that episode. They didn't even bother trying to get the American public on board with the Iran war. There's no sort of public campaign explaining to them. There's no campaign explaining to them now. No one's really prepping them for the possibility, as I laid out earlier, that they may have to invade Iran in huge numbers and take casualties and engage in occupation of Iran for a period of time even. That all has not really happened. And I think that, you know, it's really sort of a sad sort of commentary on the state of American democracy, because the people in power now feel that they can just act with impunity. They don't even have to talk to people about it. They don't have to talk. They're treating the American public basically like subjects of of a king or an imperial ruler. That's the way that Trump and the people, his courtiers around him, viziers around him are acting. I think that eventually what's going to force people to pay attention to this and not be very happy is when the economic pain starts hitting, which is going to be very, very soon. It's already started with gas prices and so forth. And, you know, gas prices are just one aspect. You think of filling your car. The entire economy is sort of built on this substrata of transportation costs. Everything will go up. Plane tickets, food, you name it. And
right.
I think at that
fertilizer.
Point, yeah. Fertilizer, yeah, absolutely. Fertilizer in the Strait of Hormuz is one of the critical export points of fertilizer to the whole world. Also, you know, the whole AI data revolution and so forth, it relies on power and also helium and things like this for manufacturing of chips and running data centers. So the whole U.S. economy is built on AI. Then what? And the whole U.S. economy, a lot of it's built on the investments from the Gulf Arab countries flushing money back into the U.S. at this point in these sort of tech investments and so forth. That's all going to dry up. Then what happens? We're in a very, very dark situation potentially. Unless someone can think of a way out, which maybe would have to entail making some other very unsavory compromises.
Absolutely. Let's put up the Ilhan Omar thing, because we'll maybe play this later, but Chris Murphy said on MS Now that Israel made us go into this war, which I think is a really interesting development to see at least the Democrats that feel that they have a future in politics as opposed to Chuck Schumer, understanding that politically that's the correct line. But I was fascinated by this clip from Dropsite from last week where your reporter, Julian, I'm so sorry, it starts with the last name, Andreoni, asked that. Thank you. At Dropsite, your colleague asked Ilhan Omar this question about potentially compromising information on Donald Trump that the Israelis may have. Now, I'm open to this theory, but I'm actually curious about what you think about it, because I think, you know, there are forces beyond simple blackmail that propel the United States into wars of aggression that we don't need to consider. But Ilhan Omar responded to this question and was not dismissive of it in a way that I thought was kind of interesting, given the fact that she has more information than we're going to have in some of these briefings as it relates to Epstein and as it relates to, wartime things. So here is a question from Dropsite about whether or not Trump is caught in Israeli honeypot.
There is to thrive on our backs.
And then the last question is, we've done a series reporting on Jeffrey Epstein's ties to intelligence agencies, namely the CIA and the Mossad. There was an Israeli spy named Yoni Korin who was basically directly under Ehud Barak, who stayed in his New York City apartment for several periods of multiple weeks on end. He negotiated a back channel between Russia and Israel during the Syrian civil war. I mean, this is geopolitical. And I'm wondering whether you think there's any self-protection going on. We spoke about special interests, but do you think there's any self-protection going on related to those ties between Epstein and Israel, and then what's coming with the Epstein policy?
Well, I called the Republicans the Pedophile Protection Party, and their chief in command is the president of the United States. Back to Russiagate, we've always talked about what blackmail for the president looks like. There's always been talks about the fact that there are compromising photos somewhere out there.
Maybe
those compromising photos exist either with the Russians or with the Israelis. And I wouldn't put it past these spy agents to use, you know, honeypot has been used by Mossad often, very documented, when it comes to their operations in Palestine, when it comes to their operations in Lebanon, when it comes to their operations in Syria and in Jordan. So I wouldn't be surprised if one of those operations includes President Trump.
Yeah, a little wink and a nod at the camera. Is there any, besides her and Rashida Tlaib, a federally elected Democrat that is speaking so plainly about Israeli intelligence honeypots? I just give her credit for even acknowledging that reality, because 99% of politicians won't. But the fact that she wasn't dismissive of how of the fact that Trump could be implicated here is really interesting to me.
Yeah, well, you know, we're all wondering what compelled this almost like suicidal decision for his presidency at the best of a foreign leader to do so much. And that's the theory which, you know, if you look at the chronology of the events of the war and so forth, it's kind of very much timed around these Epstein file disclosures and certain key depositions that are happening in the Epstein case. That's not to say that the war was launched for that reason per se. I don't have any evidence to suggest that, but certainly it's being used conveniently to snowball and sort of like snow in, you could say, the public focus on that subject. I do wonder at this point, how bad could any photo or whatever of Trump be at this point to, you know, his supporters don't care anyways. There's a lot of bad stuff in the files that have been released, you know, one way or another. What could he really be to force him to do that? I don't really know. Another theory people have had is that maybe he's threatened. Maybe Netanyahu threatened him or his family. I really don't know about that, to be honest. There's so much there. Trump is such a cipher. He's sort of someone who's very much, although he's decisive in some ways, he's also very much susceptible to influence by the people around him, his court, you know, individuals, people around him in the White House and so forth. And they can use various forms of coercion and incentivization and manipulation, of which, you know, it could be some negative thing, information about him. No one knows. It could be financial pressure. It could be many different things. That's a problem with having sort of a corrupt government. You, when you have a public officials who are corrupt, they don't necessarily act in a way which is rational towards national interest. You don't have public servants. You have people who are acting on their own personal benefit. And I think that Trump is obviously an individual like this. He's an individual like this par excellence. And it leads to these questions. So I would like to see if Ilhan Omar has information about that or suggestions about that. I would hope that that becomes public in the future, because I think the public needs to know, especially since they're killing and dying now in a foreign country for reasons which are to this day very unclear.
Lastly, before we let you go, Murtaza, I just wanted to ask you about what the damage to Israel and some of the other deaths and injuries to U.S. troops, like what those numbers and what that damage actually looks like. I mean, you're not going to know fully. No one knows. There's very strict censorship out of Israel about Iranian missiles penetrating the Iron Dome, although we've had some unconfirmed footage come out of Israel. They could arrest you for publishing that. I mean, we talk about Israel as a democracy, but they're not letting Western reporters into Gaza, but Iran is letting Western reporters into their country to report on this, just to give people a sense. On Tuesday, the Pentagon kind of whispered 140 U.S. service members have been wounded, which was a lot higher than had been previously known, and we're getting kind of slowly them announcing the deaths of U.S. service members. What has, you know, DropSight found, and what is your view on what, like, the actual damage to both Israel and kind of U.S. forces and installations actually is?
Well, you know, since the start of the conflict, I've been getting messages from people who are connected to the military families, saying that there's a tremendous number of U.S. wounded in Germany and elsewhere have been evacuated. And, you know, I think the public disclosures about this have not really been very forthcoming. I think what they're trying to do is drip out this information, such that if you were to release information about a very large number of people injured or killed in the war right at the beginning, you might generate opposition to the war continuing right up front. So I do think that deaths sometimes are a bit harder to conceal, in the sense that people in the military families tend to talk to each other and these things get out. Some deaths in Kuwait and Saudi Arabia have been reported as like medical conditions. People deployed there who died in medical conditions without any other explanation. So that's a way you can also fudge the data a little bit. And then the wounded, you know, you mentioned there was a stark disclosure by Reuters earlier this week about 150 wounded in that attack in Kuwait. That's a lot of people, and some number of them are apparently serious wounded, people who could still pass away. So this is only the early phases of the war, and the war is not really, nothing has been settled by any means at this point. So Trump has been saying he expects the numbers to rise, so that suggests he maybe had more, more plans for escalating the conflict. It's hard to say at the moment. With regards to Israel, you know, it's very important that during the 2025 war, the last war with Iran and Israel, There were this huge number of videos that came out of Israel of ballistic missiles striking targets in Israel, in some cases doing very devastating damage, destroying whole city blocks, huge military buildings, security buildings in Tel Aviv were hit. And I think this, they would not like to reprise that information disclosure. They don't want a situation again where people are looking at those videos and assessing the damage and extracting political insights from that or even intelligence insights. This time they're making it very much under lock and key. But you get some hints of what's going on there, because as you can see, the report in the Israeli press, the numbers of property damage claims, people apparently wounded in attacks and so forth. I don't think we really know at all, but it doesn't sound very good. And secondly, it's a very, very important detail we have gotten from Israel, is that because of the Iranian destruction of many of the sensors in America's integrated missile defense system in the region, those sensors are supposed to give people in Israel advance warning for when missiles are coming. So you should get like 10, 15 minutes of warning. Now you're getting like 2 minutes, or you're not even getting a warning sometimes. The missile is just hitting. So that shows you these sensors are degrading a lot, and they're being struck more often and more harshly. And, you know, last night on Wednesday, the Hezbollah and Iran launched an integrated shared attack on Israel. Hezbollah launched many, many missiles from Lebanon while Iran's launching from Iran. They're coordinating with each other. That's meant to overwhelm the system, such as whatever exists today. And I think the operation is still ongoing as well, too. We've been told that drops have reported this, that the Iranians plan to focus more on hitting Israel in the future and not the Gulf states. So, one can imagine.
Wow, due to their success, that's I mean, because the hypothesis had been the drone attacks, you're going to get more bang for your buck, for lack of a better phrase, attacking the Gulf states, and then you can put pressure on the U.S. that way. But is that kind of the assessment now? Is that the missile attacks have been effective enough that they're going to continue?
Well,
on Israel,
we sort of glean from this, and it kind of makes sense according to their strategy, is that the initial waves of missiles were not meant to hit anything. They're meant to exhaust the missile interceptors. So they fired that lower end older missiles at Israel during that time, just to kind of, drain that down a little bit. They're saving the good missiles for when the defenses are down. And that's when they're firing. That's what they said publicly and reported as well, too. They're saving those missiles in eastern Iran and the missile bases which haven't really been hit, to hit Israel when the defenses are weaker, and then they can extract a lot of damage. So really, every missile fired now is an investment on a larger attack expected to come later. So that's actually why I agreed recently with the Israelis and the Americans would like to end the war, too, because leaving aside all the economic consequences I mentioned, their situation starts looking very unenviable the longer the war goes on. And, America and Israel, their militaries are designed to fight short, quick, decisive, brutal wars. They're not meant to fight long wars of attrition. Iran's military is meant to fight a war of attrition. So their advantages militarily start to accrue the longer the war goes on. And there's an example of this from the Iran-Iraq war. The Iranians fought an 8-year war with Iraq. A million people died in that war. And many of the leaders of the country are veterans of that war. So what's going on right now is not really the worst thing that's ever happened to them, per se. They've been through things like this, worse things in the past. Whereas for the U.S. and Israel, they don't really have any desire or capacity to fight a conflict like that. It would disrupt the Israeli economy. We have mentioned all the reasons it would be very disruptive in America. They don't really want a conflict like that. So, we have sort of a misalignment of expectations here. The one thing is that how much punishment are the Iranians willing to take? And it seems like they're willing to take a lot, because their view is that if they just, tap out today, what's going to happen is that the U.S. and Israel are going to rearm themselves. In 6 months, they'll be back hitting them again with the advantage again. Better to just do it all now. Bite the bullet, accept that we're going to take a lot of suffering now, but hit them nonstop, keep going for months, years, whatever it takes to keep to gain the advantage, at the end of which you may be in a very, very different situation. So I think that's the situation. And the missile interceptors are basically exhausting at the point that myself and others expected them to exhaust in the war. And the war will get a lot more painful for the Gulf Arab states and for Israel should the Iranians continue to fire.
Murtaza Hussain, a reporter covering national security and foreign affairs at Dropsite News. I mean, one of the best in the business right now. Can't thank you enough for your work. Really appreciate your time today.
Thanks, Ellen.
Thank you. With that, folks, we're going to wrap up the free part of this show and head into the fun half. We will read your IMs. We'll probably take your calls. We'll see how it goes. Matt, what's happening with the Jackman show and with Life Reckoning?
A great Left Reckoning earlier this week. Tomorrow on the Jacobin Show, Ido Ilam, the refusenik from Israel, will give us a update on what it's like being anti-war in Israel in this current moment. He's going to record that with David soon, siren permitting. And also Kurt Hackbarth and Jose Luis Granada Ceja, I believe, will be talking about Sheinbaum's debt relief and other stuff that's going on with our neighbors south of the border. So check that out tomorrow. New time at 3 o'clock p.m. Eastern time. Jacobin Show will be on after after a little bit after Majority Report. So check that out.
Check that out. And also today... It's all right. Also today, I'm going to be on the Bituation Room with Francesca Fiorentini. We did sell out the live show that is in, you know, a week and a half in L.A. But if you want to watch it, you can become a member at not jointhemajorityreport.com, but you can become a patron of the Bituation Room. But I'm going to probably be doing Francesca's show like once a month going forward just because we like to chat. We'd like to enjoy our time together. So I'll be on today, this afternoon, pretty shortly after this show wraps. Hello, Brandon.
Hello.
How are you today?
I'm doing wonderfully. How are you doing?
I am doing well. What's happening on the discourse?
Well, a lot of things are happening on the discourse. But before I tell you, I just want to say that yesterday was my mother's birthday. So happy birthday, Mom.
Oh, happy birthday, Brandon's mom. That's very wholesome of you.
Mamala of the country.
Exactly. She may not be the mamala of the country, but she's the mamala of my heart and also me, literally. That being said, over on the discourse, we are, I mean, we stream every morning between 8 a.m. to 12 p.m. Eastern. So head over to the discourse with Brandon over on YouTube. We should have some more clips out today. We've been following, I don't know if you've been following the Jimmy Dore, Alex Jones debate.
I have not, no.
So, yeah, I mean, we've been following that. We've also been covering the UK's attempt to get rid of jury trials for a certain subset of cases there. So, you know, check out the discourse over on YouTube, over on Twitch. Where, you know, use your third eye, remote view it, whatever you want to do.
All right, do it, folks. We'll have
just do it
soon. We are going to head into the fun half. JoinTheMajorityReport.com, JustCoffee.coop. You know the drill. See you in the fun half.
Okay, Emma, please.
Well, I feel that my voice is sorely lacking on the Majority Report.
Wait, whoa. Look, Sam is unpopular.
I do deserve a vacation at Disney World. So, ladies and gentlemen, it is my pleasure to welcome Emma to the show.
It is Thursday.
I think you need to take over for Sam.
Yes, please.
I'm gonna pause you right there.
Wait, what?
You can't encourage Emma to live like this. And I'll tell you why. Someone's offered a tour, sushi, and poker with the boys. Tour, sushi, and poker with the boys. Someone's offered a tour, sushi, and poker with the boys.
What?
Tour, sushi, and poker.
Tim's upset.
Tour, sushi, and poker with the boys. Someone's offered a tour, sushi, and poker.
That's what we call the biz.
Tour, sushi, and poker with the boys.
Right.
Tour, sushi, and poker.
We're gonna get demonetized.
I just think that what you did to Tim Pool was mean.
Free speech.
That's not what we're about here. Look at how sad he's become now. You shouldn't even talk about it. I think you're responsible.
I probably am in a certain way, but let's get to the meltdown here.
Tour, sushi, and poker with the boys.
Oh my god.
Tour,
wow.
Sushi.
I'm sorry, I'm losing my fucking mind.
Someone's offered a tour, sushi, and poker with the boys.
Logic.
Tour, sushi, and poker with the boys. Boy.
Tour, I think I'm like a little kid. I think I'm like a kid.
Had this debate 7,000 times.
I'm
losing my fucking mind.
Some people just don't understand.
So I'm not trying to be a dick right now, but like, I absolutely think the U.S. should be providing me with a wife and kids.
That's not what we're talking about here.
Okay, all right. It's not a fun job.
Tour? That's a real thing. That's real thing.
Boys.
Willy Wonka tour? That's a real thing. That's real thing.
What's that offered a tour?
That's a real thing.
That's real thing.
Real thing.
Boys.
That's
a tour?
A real thing.
That's real thing.
Real thing.
Boys.
That offered a tour?
Ladies and gentlemen, Joe Rogan has done it again.
That offered a tour?
That's a real thing.
That's poker with the boys.
I think he might be blowing it out of proportion.
Real thing.
That's poker with the boys.
That offered a tour?
That's a real thing.
That's poker.
Let's go, Joe.
Tour?
Sushi?
going on?
Live YouTube.
Sam has like the weight of the world on his shoulders.
Poggers.
Sam doesn't want to do this show anymore. It was so much easier when the Majority Report was just you. You were happy.
Let's change the subject.
Rangers and Knicks are doing great.
Now shut up. Don't want people saying reckless things on your program.
That's one of the most difficult parts about this show.
This is the pro-killing podcast.
I'm thinking maybe it's time we bury the hatchet.
Left is best. Trump. Violet. Twerk.
Don't be foolish and don't fucking tweet at me and don't bitch. The way Emma has cucked all of these people. Love it.
That's where my heart is, so I wrote my honors thesis about it.
Oh, sorry. She wrote an honors thesis. I should hand the main mic to you now.
You are to the right of the foreign policy.
We already fund Israel, dude. Are you against that?
That's a tougher question. I have an answer to.
Incredible theme song.
I Bumbler.
Emma Viglin, absolutely one of my favorite people. Actually, not just in the game, like period.
We are back, folks. It is the fun half of the Majority Report. We're still waiting on Matt Binder. We are in the phones, but we're not opening them up quite yet. Read some IMs, and then we'll get into some clips. Darth Moose. In Emma's song, Tim sang, "I'm feeling like a little kid," and then skateboarding into Trump's arms is chicken soup for my soul. Also, Michael sang Logic. We never listened to it, so I don't know exactly what people are referring to. I need to familiarize myself with the song, but...
No, we don't play it in the studio.
The Emmajority song. The Emmajority song.
It's good. I played the gym.
Tim Pool wrote a song called Emma's Song. Oh. That's how I heard that.
That would be great. Oh, could you imagine?
It's acoustic.
It's his, and he just stole it from John Denver and just changed the name.
No, it's that like Blink 182, like ding 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 ding.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there's also
Brian
a song,
song called.
What's called? Yeah.
There's also Bon Iver for Emma. There's that's So he has some options.
I would
to
love
work
to
from.
See Tim Pool try to sing like Bon Iver.
Some sort of like he's not punk. Some sort of like alt rock 2000s version of Bon Iver, speeding it up. Bon Iver is good politics. So
what? I mean, soon he'll be in his experimental phase. Like, he'll be in his experimental music phase. Like, Eddie Vedder, maybe he'll switch over to something a little bit more exotic, like a sitar. Like, he'll start playing, like, the shamisen.
I don't know.
Prayer Beatles.
Yeah, you're like George Harrison going to India. You think that Tim Pool has that capacity? Mini psychologist. Definitely thought Emma was going towards, speaking of oligarchs, a word from some of our sponsors. No. I was not doing that. Bailey Schumer 2028 says it's important to note that the woman who leaked the video of the Palestinian prisoner being raped by the IDF only did so to force an investigation by Israel so that the ICC would not have jurisdiction. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, they investigated and found that they did absolutely nothing wrong. So,
I mean, that's important because, like, you know, if you don't investigate, then you don't get the benefit of complementarity, like, or something like that, where, you know,
right.
The ICC steps in.
Science is Political said, my ears perk up when I hear MR read from scientific studies. Teddy Yahoo, you all don't appreciate Trump enough. He is removing all the migrants to free up those jobs when AI takes all the desk jobs. Ugh. Polished granite counter tabletop issues says two words, more Murtaza. Yeah, Murtaza was great.
Support places like Dropsite and Zateo and The Lever and American Progress.
Yep.
We'll be supporting Zateo tomorrow with Mehdi Hassan.
Yes, we will. Let's see what we have going on here in sound. Do we have Binder? No?
You want to do another,
I'll read some IMs while we bring him in. Sergeant Flux, keep in mind military contractors are hired separately from service members, and reporting on their deaths or injuries are de-emphasized by the government. Hell, the government has been doing this for years to avoid extra scrutiny with the public for previously unpopular wars. Yes.
That's why it's funny Trump saying, like, maybe we'll bring back the draft. And I did appreciate Greg Stoker's comment on that, which was like, go ahead, try that.
Yeah. Good luck. Pittsburgh Wizard, Tim Pool's India is Canada.
I don't think he'd like that because they call his hat like a took up there, and that doesn't sound very masculine.
I mean, if he was like going to India and doing the Hare Krishna thing, right? Like, he could probably embrace his baldness a little bit more.
Oh yeah, if he like became a monk, a Buddhist monk.
Yeah, a Buddhist monk. That's how he'll be free. And he'll be having the exact same amount of sex.
He's got those two extra bedrooms.
How the fuck am I going to sell this property?
It's a dangerous neighborhood. Yeah. I wouldn't live there. Always getting shot at. Yeah.
It's in the center. Okay, so do we not have Binder? What's the deal? Okay. All right. Well, we gotta go. So, what do we have here? What is good? Yeah, we'll get to that.
This is funny too. It's the same thing. Jake Paul and this one.
Okay.
I love this guy. I love this guy. I'd like to hear.
What number is this?
This is 20.
Okay. Let's let Binder in. He's here. We'll read some IMs and then we'll do it. Binder, you here?
Yeah, I'm not sure what was going on. I couldn't hear you guys for a second.
No. All good. What's happening on your shows?
Oh, we're live. Oh, yeah.
Yes.
8:30 p.m. Eastern time at youtube.com/MattBinder. We have a few guests joining us. Tune in to catch the episode.
All right. Let's just jump right into this then. So what number is this again?
20.
So this is the guy who's... This is the guy who's running against Thomas Massie.
Yeah.
And
to see this guy.
Trump is trying to will this into existence because Thomas Massie dared to stand up to him about the Epstein files, and him and Ro Khanna, their bill was responsible for the release of these Epstein files. And so ever since then, Trump has been saying how he's going to primary the hell out of this guy. But Kentucky is a really weird place. I mean, Rand Paul sort of has the kind of similar libertarian branding that Massie does. And frankly, I'm sorry, Trump, with independents and even with some of the Republicans, they may like you. But the Epstein files release is quite popular, and Massie tying his name to that would benefit him in pretty much any state that he's running in at this point. I think this is one issue where he really overestimates his grip on Republicans. But this is the guy that Trump has endorsed to unseat Massie, and you can see why.
I hope the fake news gets this. Tom Massie stands with the ladies of the View. Tom Massie stands with the ladies of the View. Mr. President, we stand with you. Fight, fight, fight! USA!
Oh my God.
I'm telling you, that is the greatest candidate.
Wow. Is it just me or does this guy look like Bolsonaro a little bit? Is it just because it's like a small window?
Or Michael Flynn, if he kind of got one of those patented facelifts. But I do like how we've moved from Obama's in bed with the terrorists. You know, Obama stands with the terrorists. Now we're on to Tom Massie stands with the ladies of the View.
Ladies of the View.
The View.
The ladies of the View.
The gender extremists at the View.
Yes. The ladies at the View, they're coming to take your jobs. Don't you feel it there in Kentucky? Whoopi Goldberg is right about to replace you at the factory.
He sounds so Southern, he turned into like Norwegian.
The View. Yeah, exactly. It sounds like the Swedish chef.
And doesn't, we all know.
What in tarnation?
We all know what the axis of evil is. It's Joy Behar, Whoopi Goldberg, yeah, and I can't remember the third person on there.
No idea. Who's
no, Hasselbeck hasn't been on there for like 20 yeah, years.
They swap I was a say lot.
Barbara Walters. Barbara, I mean, she died like last century.
But and yet she still hosts The View. I'm not sure if you're aware of this.
But to the conservative, she's basically like Emmanuel Goldstein in 1984. Like it's The View is this underground opposition.
Right. Yes. Yes. Oh gosh, the radicals at The View.
I think it's just because of probably a lot of the people in their lives that they hate watch stuff like that, mm-hmm, where it's like, oh, yeah, my wife watches that, and they're sometimes talking about lady issues, and that makes me feel disenfranchised or something. So I think it's aimed at a certain type of conservative voter for the person in their life who watches The View is like the radical liberal.
Right. And also, I think they strenuously object to women being on their television who are not there as like purely sex objects. So they're women that have opinions. Many of them are women that are above the age of 50 or in their the middle part of their life. And for Republicans, that means you should basically not be seen or heard from ever again. It's also like daytime competition for Fox News. So it's like it's a political show that appeals to women, probably their wives, as you're saying. Brandon.
It also is the perfect encapsulation of where the conservative and right wing like mindset has gone in terms of who they view as their arch nemesis. It's no mm-hmm. longer like the politicians on the other side of the aisle, their biggest villains.
Or the terrorists.
Their biggest villains are the liberal coded TV hosts that include some celebrities, I guess, that don't like them or that they don't like.
And that's like almost been where Trump kind of fits in the emotional psyche of the MAGA supporter, which is as a person who fulfills their fantasies. He goes up there and says slurs. He says things that are untrue, but they get a thrill out of the fact that he can say it because it feels true for them. It's the quote from right after he got elected where that guy on Wall Street told, I think it was like the Financial Times or something, we get to say the R word again. Trump acts like the guy, he's their id. He's a manifestation of the person who can go after all of the liberals that bother you. And for, I guess, this audience, it's the ladies at The View.
The ladies at The View!
Yeah, but I mean, to Matt Bender's point, like, it really is a sign of how low they've been laid by just decades of, you know, propaganda by the Republicans. Like, they can't afford gas. They can't afford to send their kids to school. They can't afford a lot of things. Like, the Trump voters, at least the ones who aren't billionaires, can't afford things. And things are going to become even more unaffordable. But, yeah, you can say slurs, I guess, if you don't mind, like, you know, losing whatever job you still have. Or at least the president can say slurs. It's all seems so very petty. People have really lowered their standards.
I mean, look, gas might cost $5 a gallon, but you can stay home and just hate the women on TV.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, Thomas Massie stands with the victims of Jeffrey Epstein and the ladies of The View. I stand with the girls that Trump abused. And by stand with, I mean stand next to.
It's actually a great like test of how much the Republican voter is just a cow that can't think. Because Massey, look, Massey's not obviously like, I don't share an ideology with Thomas Massie.
Right.
That he's willing to stand up against war and also call out his party for being led by people trying to protect a pedophile conspiracy, to see if that could lose. And also, he's articulate. Like, he's not like socially weird. This guy is a freak. Like, look at his damn hair. You put him up again, like this guy.
Okay, don't call that hair. He looks like X-Files. We don't know that for sure.
He looks like the Rain King in the X-Files.
It could be someone's hair. Oh my god, he does. Well,
here, let's just play this again.
I hope the fake news gets this. Tom Massie stands with the ladies of The View. Tom Massie stands with the ladies of The View. Mr. President, we stand with...
Like, if Kentucky Republicans decide, like, yeah, I'm going to overthrow the incumbent advantage of Massie for this freak, it says everything that maybe Sagar and Jetty needs to know about the Republican voter in this country.
I mean, yeah. Thomas Massie is a very dangerous potential future candidate for the Republicans if you're, you know, even nominally on the left, because he's looked at amongst Republicans, even the ones who are drifting further to the right, as like one of the only principled ones left. Because it's not even just the Epstein files or the war in Iran that he has differentiated himself with Trump on. Trump hates him for a lot of reasons. He won't sign a lot of Trump's expansive bills that give money to all sorts of things, you know, that I would agree with, but also things that I wouldn't agree with, like the military. Like, he stands by a lot of the principles Republicans claim to care about, which I don't agree with, but Republicans don't even actually stand by in the end. And in that sense, like, he, just like Marjorie Taylor Greene, once everything has been laid bare by Trump's presidency, are going to come out looking like, you know, incredibly principled compared to not just even your average Republican, but your average Democrat, who will likely sign on to like fund this war at some point if it continues.
I, you know, Sam and I had a little bit of a back and forth about this, about whether or not this is going to hurt some of these cabinet officials politically going forward. And you know, I really do think it is. I don't necessarily I think that people are going to, like in 2016, the Republicans, whenever the Trump is gone, they're going to try to look for a candidate. And I don't know if it's going to be Massey, but it'll be somebody who maybe was a little bit more skeptical of this kind of thing to represent them. Because even though the whole conservative Republican apparatus is in bed with the neocons, Trump went out there in 2016 on the national debate stage and said the Iraq war was a big fat mistake. And
the same week Scalia died.
Right. And so, like, once, I mean, Trump's unpopularity right now is where Bush's was and close to it towards the end of his second term. Now, Bush didn't have a cult in the base the way Trump does, so it's a bit of a different dynamic. And I wonder how in the future Republicans are going to deal with the specter of Trump and MAGA over, you know, their political futures. But I could very much see a replay of that 2016 dynamic where it's somebody who distances themselves from this horrible war, or from, you know, the Epstein files as well, where they can at least rhetorically kind of signal to the base, hey, I'm not one of the bad ones.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's what makes the Republican Party a lot more dangerous in this aspect than the Democratic Party is, at least for the internal power brokers of that party. The Republican Party is just ultimately more democratic than the Democratic Party is internally when it comes to choosing candidates oftentimes. And so that means that, especially as they create the fertile ground for radicalization, not just in America, but in their own party by facilitating stuff like Donald Trump, in the future, it's likely they'll continue to be taken over, not by the MAGA movement or the Tea Party movement, but whatever comes next after that. Maybe like it's just an outright neo-Nazi thing. But because of the fact that the internal power brokers of that party understand that that's not incommensurate with like the way, you know, Capital wants to run things anyway, they'll let it happen. It's the Democrats who can't afford to be that way, because what the power brokers in that party want, what the core establishment wants, is just so radically antithetical to what their base actually wants, that to let them get control over it, even like the average their average NPR liberal, to let them get actual control over the party outside of like token representation from a Hakeem Jeffries, would be a radical shift from the pro-corporate politics of the Democratic Party, at least to, you know, I think the people who fund them.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right about that. Pool says Tucker Carlson is going to absolutely run against Trump's record to win the Republican nomination. I think that's there's a very distinct possibility that that happens.
It makes sense. On TV is a typical launching pad for Republicans, from like Reagan to
celebrities. That's their most revered figures, are people who are already celebrities, and Tucker is clearly trying to at the very least carve out some, you know, part of the base for himself, and he's going to still be able to hit on the notes of what like the Republicans actually like, which is he hates immigrants, he supports what ICE is doing.
Right. His whole thing is like, why are we helping Israel with a war when we could just be rounding up more people at home?
Yeah. And his whole thing also is like the pitting, saying essentially that the Jews are the bad ones now, moving on from his view about Muslims being violent monkeys before. Now it's Jewish people that are controlling our foreign policy and then they're making all these decisions. It's so there always will be some sort of group that Tucker can scapegoat, and there will always be an appetite for racialized or ethnic scapegoats in the Republican Party. But he can now say, I was in opposition to Israel and I was in opposition to this war. Let's open up the phone lines now. 646-257-3920. Planter Dakota says, but a lot of Appalachian anti-government sentiment seeps out into that area as well, so it makes Massey popular. Yeah. Kentucky is like a weird state in the way that Vermont and Maine are kind of weird states politically, or Alaska is. They have their own political tradition.
Massey is a lot less weird to me than whatever the hell Gallerine is up to.
Yeah.
It's like a Nazi that escaped to Argentina or something.
Yeah. Scientist from Maine, that voice cracking on the final fight really sold it for me. Calling from a 308 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
It is Kowalski from Nebraska.
Kowalski from Nebraska. I thought it might be you. Would love your thoughts on what's happening right now with fertilizer, given Trump's war in Iran. So what's happening over Kowalski Family Farms?
There is no war in Ba Sing Se.
Oh,
everything
thank
is
you.
Fine. There is no need to be planting Liberty Gardens at all. It's good. This is all part of the plan.
Yes. Trump did say, yeah, it's not a war. There's no war in Iran. It's an excursion. So there might be an excursion in Ba Sing Se, but not a war in Ba Sing Se.
Yes. The trade disputes with the Fire Nation. It's fine. No. The situation there is pretty bad. I actually got to go on the Humanist Report with Mike recently to talk about the fertilizer thing. So if anybody wanted to see more in depth there, I encourage people to go watch that video. But essentially, we need liquid natural gas, LNG, out of the Gulf states. Qatar is one of the biggest nations in the region that exports liquefied natural gas, which is absolutely needed for countries like India and even the European markets, and to a lesser degree that LNG needs to make it to the Western Hemisphere. The U.S. will pick up a lot of the slack, but there's only so much we can export, so don't expect a shortage of food, but do expect there to be some food inflation as the price of all of these goods go up. That's pretty much the big takeaway on the food front, and I mean, at this point, it looks like if the war stopped now, somehow you could convince all these people in Iran who have lost loved ones to not have, you know, vengeance in their heart, and I would not blame them for it. It would take us probably 90 days to resolve the just where all the ships are,
because wow,
like everything's out of whack, like during COVID. So like there's just a buildup of ships in the wrong locations. So we should experience some food inflation. It'll be less in like Europe and North America, probably more in the global South.